Hi. I think I'll get going. So my name's Kai Hofmeester, and I'm going to talk to you today about designing metro-style apps that are touch-optimized. I am a designer, and I just worked for the past 2 years in the Windows design team over in Redmond. And I worked on input methods, mostly on touch, on designing touch for Windows. And that's what I'll be talking about today. But before I start, I'd like to tell you a little story. Because before I worked in Windows, I worked at Surface, at Microsoft Surface. And I started there about 4 years ago. And one of the problems that we had at Surface was to try to get people to touch the screen. Because when people would walk up to a computer, they weren't necessarily used to touching the screens. They were used to mouse. So we had this problem. And one of the ways that we tried to solve this problem was by putting this big glowing hand on the screen. It was kind of just about the size of your own hand. And there were these little flecks of kind of what we call pixel dust flowing around them. And we tried to get people to touch the screen using that visual. So in one instance, we had a user study. We had a participant come into the room. She sat down next to the Surface. And then the researcher would ask her a bunch of questions. But in the meantime, she sat there with her hands down. And this glowing hand was right in front of her. And she really wanted to touch it. So halfway, she interrupted the researcher. And she was like, "Can I touch the screen now?" Because she wanted to put her hand on the screen. What I think is interesting about this is that right now we don't think about that at all anymore. Everybody's completely used to touching screens. I touch screens all the time, and half the time they don't work yet because they're not yet touch-enabled, and then I'm kind of pissed off that it doesn't work. But that's only in the period of 4 years, right? 3 or 4 years. Like 4 years ago, we weren't used to touching screens, and now we think it's completely normal to touch screens. And that has a lot of implications for us, I think, that short time period and how much we know about touch. So if there's one thing that I want you to walk away with today, it is that touch is a language. And what does that mean? What does that mean for what we have to do? What does it mean for designing an app? What does it mean for programming apps? So what I'll do is I'll give you a little bit of background of what I mean with touch is a language, with what that touch is a language. And I'll give you some examples of other input languages. And then I'll get into explaining what the Windows 8 touch language is, what the characteristics of that are, and what that means for you. And then at the end, there will be time for questions. But again, I'll start with Surface. So what was really nice about Surface is that there was not a lot of legacy. So we had a lot of opportunity to experiment and to try out different things. And when I started there, I was asked to develop a new touch language from the ground up so we could do anything we wanted to, basically. So we did a lot of experimenting. We tried out lots of different kinds of things. Some of them worked and some of them didn't work. But the main thing that it helped me do is to help me understand what it means, what a touch language means, what it is, what's good about it, and what's bad about it. First, I want to show you an example of some of those experiments we did that actually went wrong. And what you see here is a setup in the user research lab at Surface. So there's a Surface table in the front. Those two people are participants in the study. Because Surface is a multi-user environment, we always ask people to come in pairs, two people. So this is a father and a daughter. And then on the right-hand side, you just see the hand of the researcher who's holding up a piece of paper. And on that paper, there's a picture, and the people in the study are asked to recreate that picture, that same configuration on the screen. So basically what they have to do is they have to move that window to a different place and make it larger. But what we didn't do is tell them how to do that, because we developed a kind of a new way of interacting with content. And the idea was that if you would use one finger, you would move the content within the window. If you would use two fingers, you would move the whole window. And the idea was that it was kind of like a virtual pressure. So the harder you press, the more things you move. Like you could move a whole stack of papers, for instance. So it seemed like a pretty simple concept. But watch closely to what they're doing, what they think, how it should work. Let me see. Hang on.
That's right. See how you were moving it inside the pain? Wait, this means I can freeze the pain. Don't know how I did it. But now you reach inside. No, with two hands. There you go. There you go.
So we're very grateful to these users to be really kind of working with us and trying out different things. And I think normal people, by this time, they would have just walked away. But these people kind of kept going at it. And in the end, the way that they thought that we wanted them to interact with the system is that one person actually holds the window while the other person scrolls the content. And they're kind of pretty serious about it. So obviously, this is not a direction that we went in. But what I wanted to kind of explain is that we made lots of mistakes. There's lots of things that we tried out that actually didn't work. And one of the main things that I learned from these kinds of experiments is that people think with a mouse brain. So often when they interact with the touch system, what they actually do is that they imagine that they're using a mouse. And one of the ways that you kind of know this is when they tap on the screen, they call it clicking, even though there's nothing clicking at all, but they're referring to clicking with the mouse. And it's also what we do. When we create interfaces for touch, often we use the mouse metaphors and the mouse way of interacting with things, and then we kind of recreate that for touch. The only thing we do is we make the buttons bigger. And I don't think that's the right thing to do. And to explain that, let me take a step back to show you what that actually means, how these languages develop. So the way I think this happens is that when a new technology gets introduced, such as mouse or as touch, first there's three stages that technology goes through. In the first stage, we're just playing with the technology. We're just trying out things. What can you do with it? How cool is it? But we're not actually using it for specific purposes yet. In the second stage, what we do is we copy an old language. So we take something that we understand. We take a metaphor or some other technology we understand, and we map that to this new technology. And then only in the third stage do we actually develop a language for that new technology. Now, I have a few examples to show you what that means. And the reason I'm showing you these examples is so that you understand better where we are with touch. So the first example is movie cameras. So when the movie camera was invented, initially what we did is just kind of play around and see what you could do with it. So for instance, MyBridge created these movies of running horses to figure out like exactly how do they run, what kind of gaits do they have. But that was all that we did initially, just kind of play around with the technology. Then in the second stage, what happened is we took movie cameras and we place them in theaters, like literally where the audience is. So where you are, we would put a camera like right in the middle of the audience and then film a play in a static way. So the camera didn't move. The play was not any different than how it was if there would be a real audience sitting there. We would film that play and then put the projector in a different theater and then just project that play. So basically we used the language of theater with the new technology of movie cameras. And then only in the third stage, when movies like Citizen Kane were released, did we start creating a language for movies. And that language includes zooming, panning, moving the camera to different locations, cuts, things like that. Before this language was developed, those words and those ideas didn't exist. There was no idea of zooming or panning a camera because there was no camera, and so that whole language didn't exist. Right now, that language is completely normal. We all know it, and it's almost like it's been around forever, but it hasn't been. It's only been around since the 50s. Now, something similar happened with mouse. So as you probably all know, the first mouse was invented in 1968. This is a mouse that was invented by Douglas Engelbart in Stanford University. There's actually another one that was invented at almost the same time by Telefunken. But that's the first mouse. And initially, it was just kind of a cool thing. You're like, oh, this is interesting. You can determine an XY coordinate on the screen. There wasn't even a pointer. And then in the second stage, what we did is we used the mouse, but we used it with the command line interface. So there's still text in, text out on the screen, but now you can position your cursor using the mouse. And it took until 1974, which was about 5 years later, when Aalto when Xerox released the Alto computer. And that was the first instantiation of the graphical user interface. And this is the mouse language. This is a language that was specifically developed for mouse, with windows, icons, the mouse, and pointers, or menus and pointers. So again, I hope you can see the similarities between what happened with movies and what happened with mouse. Now, what does that mean for touch? Oh, let me first tell you a little bit about what does that mean for an input language, and then I'll talk about touch. So there are several things that make up these languages that have to, that are developed in that stage three. The first thing is input properties. So there's the properties of the technology, and there are the properties of the human who is interacting with it, us. For instance, for a mouse, it's this box that's on the table that, that you can move it horizontally and vertical, so it has an X and a Y coordinate, and you're always changing both of them. You can't change only one of them. Because you can put your hand down and rest your palm on the table, you can be very precise with your finger, so mouse gives you a lot of precision. There's a certain amount of gain because I can move my mouse a little bit, but I can set my, in my settings, I can make it so that the cursor actually moves a lot or less, so I can make it more or less precise. So those are all properties that are. And then there's also properties of my body. So for instance, with my wrist and my fingers, I can make very precise movements. With my shoulders, my movements are not so precise. So all those properties determine what that input method is good at and what it's not so good at. And those determine the interactions. So there are certain interactions that you can do with mouse. Like, for instance, you can move the cursor around. You can put the left mouse button down somewhere and then drag something over. So those are the interactions that there are. You can click the right mouse button. Then the third aspect is system feedback. So, for instance, when I move my mouse to the left, there's a cursor on the screen that moves to the left as well. When my cursor hovers over an object, that object highlights or it provides me a tooltip or something. And the last aspect is feed forward. And feed forward helps me determine what I can do. So, for instance, if I see a laptop with a touchpad, I know that I can use that to move the cursor around. If I see a mouse, I know I can use that to move the mouse. But also, if I see an interface that has a graphical user interface, then I know, oh, yeah, that's one of those that I can use with my mouse, as opposed to a command line interface, for instance. So that feed forward tells you what you can do. So those are the aspects of an input language. Now, let's have a look at touch. Touch has actually been around for a long time as well, even though only recently we're using it on a mass scale. It's been around since the late 60s, early 70s. So this is the Plato 4 system that's from 1972 that actually has a touchscreen. It only has 16 by 16 resolution, though, so it's kind of a very simple touchscreen. But they've been around for a long time. But what I think is that we are still in stage two, between stage two and stage three with touch, because we haven't developed this language that's specific for touch yet. So where we go from command line interface to graphical user interface to the touch interface, there are some things that are already new conventions. So for instance, pinch to zoom, using your two fingers to zoom, that's not something you can do with a mouse. That's developed specifically for touch, and it's become a convention that many people know. But there's other things, like how do I select something with touch? I don't know. With a mouse, you single-click to select something, and you double-click to activate it or open it. But with touch, if you tap on something, it opens it. So now how do I select something? Or how do I jump in a list? For instance, with a mouse, we have a scroll bar, and the scroll bar has a lot of functionality in it. I can use it to quickly go to the top of the list or to the bottom of the list. I can paginate. I can scroll line by line. With touch, we have this great thing which is called direct manipulation, where I can actually I can touch the list itself and move. But now I'm missing all that functionality that the scroll bar offers me. So those kinds of things, they don't exist yet. Or sometimes they do, but they're not conventions yet. So what I want to do is I want to dive into some of those examples, like specifically what those are, and then I'll start talking about how we solve for those problems in Windows. Well, one of the big ones is the fat finger syndrome, right? My finger is way bigger than the point of the cursor that you normally see on the screen. So computer systems are developed, or most computer systems are developed, to see a single XY coordinate, right? Like a single pixel on the screen is targeted with your mouse. But if I use my finger, it's like way bigger than that single pixel. So I'm covering that pixel. I don't know which one I'm touching, and I'm covering a whole bunch of other stuff around it too. So basically, all the computer sees is that little crosshair on my finger, but actually that dark gray spot is what is touching the screen. And here's an example of what can go wrong, right? So my finger can be touching the screen, but because it's so fat, I'm actually touching three buttons, but I'm definitely touching the play button that's in the middle. But all the computer sees is that little crosshair that you see on the top, from top left of that button. So according to the computer right now, I'm actually not touching the button, even though physically, obviously, I am touching that button. That can be very frustrating with touch when you use that. This is actually a picture from Windows 7. So basically, the computer doesn't speak touch. It doesn't understand the touch language. It doesn't understand fingers. And here's something that we did to solve that in Windows 8, which is an example of how we kind of solved the basics, how we made the computer understand touch. So in this video, what you'll see is you'll see somebody touching the window in the top left, and then on the bottom right-hand side, what you see is what the computer actually sees. So the little circle in the middle is the XY coordinate that the system still, that's the thing that the system understands, but the larger circle actually represents the finger touching the screen, and what we're doing is we're moving that XY coordinate, and I'll show you. So trying to target that corner, missing the target, but actually the system moves the XY coordinate to within the area of where the finger is touching the screen. And now I'm really missing it. Again, I'm just below the window, but the system moves the XY coordinate above so that I'm still touching it, because physically I'm touching it. As long as my target is within that circle, that ellipse, I'm actually physically touching the target. So this is a way to make it easier to touch smaller items, but also and to make the system more aware of the properties of fingers. And you don't have to do anything to use this. It's just built into the system. It's built into Windows 8. Another thing that we looked at is posture. So with a mouse, your posture doesn't determine very much how you can use it, because the mouse is always on a flat surface, the trackpad is always the same trackpad. But with touch, the way you're sitting or standing, how your body is positioned, posture, determines how you can interact with it. And we did a whole bunch of studies. In this case, there are field studies where we gave people tablets and we let them kind of just use them, and then we observe them. We would go in there, we would be there the first few hours when they had it, we would come back after a day, we'd come back after a week and ask them how they use it and take pictures of how they use the systems. So, and from this research, we found that there's two postures that are really important for touch, for using tablets. This is the main posture, where you're holding the tablet with one hand, which will be your non-dominant hand. So if you're right-handed, you will hold it with your left hand. And it's actually supported by some other surface. So most of the time, it's one of the legs, right? It's supported on your lap or on your leg. And sometimes it's on the table or something. So it's supported in some way. And then you use your dominant hand to be interacting with the system. And so what that means is I have one finger available, but I can theoretically or potentially have all my five fingers available to use. The second posture is holding the tablet with two hands and then using your thumbs to interact. And then there's different ways how you can hold it. You can hold it with the tablet in the palm of your hand, or you can have your hands a little bit further up. And that determines what your reach is with your thumbs. So those are the main two postures that we saw when people are using tablets. Also, based on that insight, what we did is we looked at what the reach of people is with their thumbs in this case. So here's some examples of pictures. What we did is we gave people a piece of paper the size of a slate, And then we asked them to put their fingers in finger paint. And then we asked them to reach on that piece of paper in different ways, like reach what was easy to reach, if they would stretch a little bit further, was harder to reach, and what was really hard to reach, and then outside of that is what they really can't reach. So here are some examples from different users of what they could reach or couldn't reach. And then what we did is we combined all those pictures into one statistically representative picture. So these are the areas for certain, I think this is for palm grip, where you hold the corners of the slate in the palm of your hand, what people could reach on the screen with their thumbs. So you can see how far they go. You can't reach any further than over there. But even the bottom corners are hard to reach because you can't fold your thumbs in any further than a certain way. This is limitation of your joints. And then based on that insight on which areas are easy and hard to reach, we could actually design our apps and our user interface in a better way. So for instance, we developed, in addition to the normal keyboard, we developed a thumb keyboard, which I assume you have seen, which has the keys on the left and the right-hand side of the screen. So it's a little bit like typing on a phone, but then typing with two thumbs. And that's based on the reach of the thumbs. But we also looked at the UI in the apps that we were developing to make sure that you could actually easily navigate through those apps, like scroll lists or navigate back home just using your thumbs. So that's another way we looked at touch, at what the properties of touch are, both technical and from the human point of view, and how can we optimize the system for that and how can we design for that. Another aspect that we looked at is precision. So when you're using a mouse, you're very precise, like I said, because when you use your wrist and your fingers, you can be very precise. Those muscles are trained to make really small movements. And there's actually also more brain cells dedicated to those movements. As soon as you start moving your elbow and your shoulder, you get less precise. You can make less precise movements. That's compounded by that a lot of the movements on computers are orthogonal and straight. So they're like horizontal lines and vertical lines. And those are specifically hard to make with your joints because your joints are created, what they can do easily is make circles like this. They're not very good at making straight lines. So to make a straight line, I have to move several joints at the same time in a coordinated way. So it's really hard to make a horizontal straight line. So what we did is we created a user interface that affords you to be sloppy. So you can make sloppy movements, you can move like this, but the scrolling motion will still be a straight scrolling motion. Another example, Then another example of what's important for touch is direct manipulation. I talked about that already. So direct manipulation means you can touch things on the screen and you get continuous and incremental feedback. So when I'm, and it is like the real world, right? When I touch something and I move it, I slide something over the table, I get continuous and incremental feedback of that thing sliding over the table. Well, so that's the same thing as what we want to happen on computers. When I touch something and I move it, I want to move it like direct manipulation. That seems obvious, but it's not necessarily obvious. So here's an example from Windows 7, where we're moving from picture to picture. But it's actually using what we call symbolic gestures. So you have to move over a certain distance with a certain speed to go to the next picture. And if you do that wrong, if you don't move fast enough, or if you don't move across a certain threshold, then it doesn't move. Now, the direct manipulation version is this. This is an example on the phone. It's the same gesture, so I'm still moving from left to right. I'm moving my finger from left to right. But now I'm getting this continuous and incremental feedback. So it is as if I'm moving that picture itself. So that's what we call direct manipulation. And what's really important for touch is because it is a direct input method, where a mouse is not direct, it's mediated. I'm moving the mouse moves the cursor, and the cursor moves something else. With touch, it's as if you're moving that thing on the screen itself. So we call it a more direct input method. So it's really important to make sure that direct manipulation works well. So the performance of your system has to be really well, because you're not actually moving that picture, right? You're moving your finger, and then the system is moving the picture for you. But even if we can't have real direct manipulation, we can still fake it, and we can make it seem as if you're directly manipulating objects. Another example of what we thought about for developing the Windows 8 touch language is timed gestures. So with touch, you have a certain amount of gestures that you can perform before you run out of gestures, basically, right? So you can tap on something, you can move your finger from the left to the right or up or down, then you can start doing something with two fingers, but at some point you'll run out of gestures. So one of the gestures that's often used is press and hold. So you use time to create more gestures. And so, for instance, in Windows 7, if you hold your finger down and you wait, I think, a second or something, you will get a context menu. What we are saying is we don't want to use time gestures for those kinds of important tasks. And there's two reasons for that. One is that if you use time gestures, there will be accidental invocation. So if it's a person, a user who's not so used to the system, and they hold their finger down on the system a little bit too long, they hold their finger down on the screen a little bit too long, then they will accidentally invoke something. In this case, you'll accidentally invoke the context menu, and now you're kind of stuck in context menu mode. But another example, on an iPhone, if you hold your finger down too long, all the icons will start shaking, and now you're in rearrange mode. So there's examples in different systems for that. So there will be accidental invocation for novice users. For experienced users, it actually slows them down. Because every time I want to invoke the context menu here, I have to wait a second. And the nice thing about the context menu is that it provides fast access to things. So what we're saying is, don't use time gestures for these kinds of important tasks. We can use time gestures for something else, and I'll explain that later. So I'm now almost getting to the part where I'm actually going to talk about what that Windows 8 touch language looks like. But one video I wanted to show before that is another. It's a little clip from another user study where we were testing the whole system here with users. So we created a prototype of the system, and we implemented our touch interactions. And then we were looking at how easily people could use them and what they thought of using them. So they would use them here, the interactions in the shell, in the start menu, but also in the different applications. And then we asked this person what she thought of it. By the way, again, this is the setup in one of our labs. So users could sit down comfortably on the couch, and they could sit in any position or posture that they wanted to. So she chose to sit cross-legged with a pillow and put the tablet on her lap.
Like I said, a very small learning curve. Once you know the touch, I like the fact that they're the same in every, would it be application? That once you know how to operate email, this operates the same, selecting the pictures operated the same, etc. I like the continuity. How's that?
So why I wanted to show this is that I think once you have this language and you use it in a consistent way, the advantage is that it makes it really easy for users to use the system. Because they only have to learn once how to do it, and then they can do it everywhere. They speak that language. That's part of why it's so important to have that language. So, what were the goals of the Windows 8 touch language? Well, we wanted it to be simple, not have too many interactions and things that you have to learn. You should be able to learn it quickly. And we wanted it to be consistent. So it has to work the same across the system and preferably also in all the apps. We wanted it to use direct manipulation, as I just explained, because touch is a direct way of interacting. That's really an advantage of how you can use it. Then we wanted it to use sliding interactions. So a lot of touch systems right now use tapping. There's a lot of tapping happening. That's an easy way to interact. You tap on buttons. You can tap to navigate from screen to screen. But what's actually interesting, we have all these sliding gestures that you can perform with your hands that are really easy to perform, and they convey a whole bunch more meaning to the system. So you can do many more things if you use those sliding gestures in addition to tapping. And they're as easy, if you design them well, they're as easy to perform as tapping. So I'll show you actually which interactions we have that use those sliding interactions. Then we wanted our interactions to be reversible. So if you want to make a system that's safe to learn for people and safe to use and try things out, it has to be easy to get out of what you just did. And that's why we want interactions to be reversible. So for instance, if I move something to the right, I just move my finger back to the left to undo that. I just move it back. That seems really obvious, but we wanted that to work everywhere. So while your finger's down on the screen, you can just move back to where you came from and there's no harm done. But it should also work between interactions. If I move something to the right and I lift my finger, I put my finger down and move it back to the left, I should go back to the left. It seems really obvious, I hope, but it doesn't. In many places it doesn't work. So we wanted it to work everywhere. We wanted to avoid modes as much as possible. So a mode, for instance, like the context menu I just showed, where you would press and hold, the context menu comes up, and now you can't do anything else anymore. You have to select something from the context menu. That causes a lot of errors, a lot of user errors. So we wanted to try to avoid that. And if we have modes, we wanted them to be kinesthetically held. So you have a mode that you activate by putting your finger down on the screen. As soon as you lift your finger off the screen, the mode is gone. So that has less errors. And then we wanted to limit the use of time gestures, as I just explained. Now, this is the basis of the Windows 8 touch language. These are the only 8 gestures that we have. So there is press and hold, and I'll explain what all these do in a minute. There's tapping, sliding, swipe, pinch and stretch, turn, and then swipe from the edges. And this is what those gestures do. So those are the interactions. You can press and hold to learn things, which is similar to hover with a mouse, and I'll explain that. Tapping is the primary action, so you launch an app, for instance. You can slide to pan, and then what we call swipe, and I'll explain exactly how that works, you use to select. So there's a selection gesture that works across the system. Pinch and stretch is zooming. You can turn your fingers to rotate. And then swiping from the edge, if it's the bottom or the top, it's dedicated to the app, so it has app commands. If it's from the left or the right, it's system commands. So these are all the gestures that there are in Windows 8, all the touch interactions. And what I'll do now is I'll highlight some of those interactions and I'll explain a little bit more about how they work. So the first one I want to talk about is swipe to select. So what we wanted to have is a way of selecting items so that you can act on them. And it's kind of a very basic thing that a computer system should have. If I can select something, then I can have commands, and with the commands I can do things, I can perform actions on them. And preferably you can select one thing or you can select multiple things. So how do we make that happen? Well, what we did is we created this gesture which we call swipe to select. And the way it works is, if what you're looking at is a list that scrolls horizontally, then I can move my finger orthogonal to that scrolling direction to select something. And I'll give you an example of that. So here's my start menu, my Windows 8 start menu. Now what I can do is I can hold my finger down on something and I can swipe it down. So what you see, that dark circle that you see is my finger. That's not what you would normally see on this system, but it's because I'm presenting, so you can see where my finger is. If I'm moving my finger down, I can see that check mark appear, and then the item highlights, and then when I let go, it's selected. And I can select multiple things as well if I want to. And then what you see in the bottom, the app bar appears, so that's a bar that has commands that I can now perform on that selected item. So again, I can do this to unselect, and I can select multiple items if I want to. So what it does is this makes use of the properties of the finger. So our body is built to contract muscles. This is easier. Contracting is easier than extending my muscles. And the reason is because we like to grab onto things. We like to hold things. So doing this movement with your finger is actually the easiest movement with your finger to do, to select things. So we use that property to enable one of our basic tasks, which is selecting items. Now, this is a whole new gesture, right? It's a gesture that doesn't exist. People don't know about it. So what we had to do is we had to teach people how to use it. I actually have another talk tomorrow which talks more about how to teach new gestures. But what I wanted to do is show this video, this yet another user study. This woman has just learned how to select. She actually learned it by herself. And she's been using it for, I think, 1 or 2 minutes. She had to do some tasks with it. And then after those few minutes, the researcher who's sitting on to the right, just off screen, asks her what she thinks of this gesture. And while she is answering the question, she's just playing with the screen. In this case, it's an app with music in it, music albums in it. She's just playing with the screen. So watch carefully what she does with her fingers.
Now that you've had a little more time to play with this and selecting and rearranging and the one of that menu, tell me what you liked.
Now that I know how to do the selection, I like that.
Why?
Because it takes a flick of the finger movement. It's very easy to. I can go all over a bunch of them and select.
So she's super fast, right? This is really after a few minutes, where she's just kind of for fun selecting these things and then deselecting all these items. So even though it's a whole new gesture and you have to learn how it works, it is kind of easy to learn. And once you learn, it's actually really easy to use. That's the advantage of it. So this is about the gestures don't always have to be things that we already know. Sometimes we have to develop new gestures that work well for us. We had to spend a lot of time on how to teach this gesture. So that's why there's a whole other talk about this. It didn't kind of immediately come up. It wasn't automatic, like, oh, we can just teach people how to use this gesture. Now, I can show you one example here. And this is an older version of Windows 8 that I'm showing right now. But if I hold my finger down on this item, then it actually moves down without me moving my finger down. So the idea was that if you don't know what to do, you can hold down your finger on the screen, and then the system will give you some tips about how to use it. And this is not the final version we had of that, because we had to update the animations there. But in that way, we could teach users what the gesture was. So this swipe to select is the best way to provide selection, obviously, but also to provide commanding in your app, because now this opens up the possibility of doing things with all those items that are in an app, in a collection or in a list. And the easiest way to actually use that, gesture, is by using the controls. So there's list controls and there's grid controls. And if you use that, then selection will be automatically enabled for you. What I'll do is at the end of this talk, I will provide some pointers also to more technical talks about this that explain in a kind of more detailed way how you can use those controls, in case you're interested in that. So another gesture that we developed for Windows 8 is swipe from the edge. And as I said, if you swipe from the top or the bottom, you get app commands. And if you swipe from the left or the right, you get the Windows commands. So one of the great things about it is we don't have to show user interface elements. We don't have to show visuals that are always there and that are kind of in the way of your content. But you can still always easily access those commands. The only kind of problem with it, again, is that users have to learn how to do that. But because it's always the same, it works everywhere, it is a thing you have to learn only once, and then you can always use it. So here's one example. I'm in my presentation. What I'm doing is I'm swiping my finger from the right. No, that didn't do it there. I'm swiping my finger from the right, and then I get the what's called the charms bar, so the Windows commands. If I'm swiping my finger from the left, I'm dragging in all the applications. Now, if I'm in the start menu, I want to be here. This is an example of the browser. There's no web page up right now. It's just an empty browser window. If I swipe my finger from the bottom, I get the browser commands. So the URL bar and commands, and then tabs in the top. And if I swipe it again, it goes away. So those edges can be used to always access system commands and access app commands. So again, how should you use this? Well, commands should be revealed to swiping from the edge, so we recommend putting those in the app bar. It doesn't have to be an app bar. And because it works everywhere, people who are using your apps or who are using the Windows system, they're confident about it because they know it's always there. And then, as we saw before, the two main postures that are the one where you just use your dominant hand, so often your right hand, the other one where you use your thumb, they show where you can best put commands in that app bar. So the best place is to put it near the edges, so you can reach it both with your thumbs and you can reach it with your dominant hand. So another gesture, another touch interaction I want to talk about is hold to learn. So like I said, we try to avoid using timed gestures for important commands, but instead what we wanted to do is use it for learning how to use a system. So we have new interactions, for instance, but there might also be other things that you don't know what to do or you don't know what that thing means, so how can you find that out? With a mouse and cursor system, there's a great way to do that, because you can move your cursor over an item and then the item will highlight, you get a pop-up, you can get a pop-up window which kind of can tell you this button does this or this picture has this name or give you more information about the item. With touch you can't, because either you're not touching the screen, so there's no hands at all, or you're touching the screen, and when you're touching the screen it's already too late, right, because now you're activating. So instead what we did is we said you can touch the screen and you can put your finger down and you will get more information about that item. So I'll give you some examples. So one is if I'm in this I'm in this menu here, there's on the bottom right hand side there's the power menu. And there's three things I can do, sleep, shut down, or restart. But I'm not entirely sure what sleep means. So what I can do is I can put my finger down on sleep, and then I'll get some more information about what sleep means. And then I don't have to activate if I move my finger off. Or I can put my finger on Microsoft Excel. This one doesn't have anything. And I can get more information about that app. The other thing that we're... that you can do is the one where what I just showed you, where I can put my finger down. So for instance, on the word tile in the bottom, I put my finger down on the word tile, and it has this animation, which is actually giving me a hint about how can I select. And the idea there was that we move the tile in the direction that we want you to swipe, so you can understand how that works. So those are two examples of how you can use press and hold to teach things. It can either be by giving more information or it can be teaching people how to use the system. So what it does is it provides you some extra information either to learn or to get better understanding about something without having to commit to that thing. And there's different ways of how you can use it, but there's actually a control, which is the tooltip control, which is the easiest way to enable this. So, another gesture I want to talk about is zoom. The one we all know is optical zoom. So I put two fingers down on a photo, for instance. I move them together, I move them apart. And the photo gets, you zoom in or you zoom out. Same thing with the map. But there's another way of zoom that we introduced in Windows 8, which we call semantic zoom. And what it actually does is it kind of works the same way. It also makes something bigger or larger, bigger or smaller. But when that happens, it actually changes the way that information is displayed. So it will give you a more concise overview, which I'll show in a minute what that means. The reason for this is what I talked about earlier. If you use a mouse, it is very easy to go to the beginning of a list or the end of a list. It's very easy to navigate large lists or collections because we have the scroll bar. And with the scroll bar, I can move the thumb all the way to the top or the bottom. I can quickly jump somewhere. I can also move it halfway. I can move the thumb halfway the scroll bar to go to the middle of the list, about the middle of the list. But if you use touch, you can't do that anymore. If you want to go to the middle of the list, you have to kind of swipe, 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 swipe to go there, and you don't even know if you're in the middle. So semantic zoom solves this. So for instance, I'm in my start menu. I have lots of applications. I don't want to swipe my way to the end of the list. What I can do is I put my two fingers down in the list, and I move them together, and now I get a concise overview of the list. This is very close to an optical zoom, except for that those tiles that you saw are not literally made smaller, but they're actually different tiles. So all the text is gone, and there's just the logos that you see there. So that's a simple version of semantic zoom, and then I can quickly jump to one place. Now here's an example of where it changes more. So these are all the apps that I have. Like, it's a whole long list. I need to jump to, I don't know, somewhere two-thirds of the list. What I can do is I can zoom out, and it actually changes the view. So now I just have an alphabet view. And then on the right-hand side, I have my folders that I created. And then I can quickly jump to the maintenance folder, for instance. So semantic zoom is a concept of using zoom, but there's only two levels. There's the normal view that you have, and then there's a simplified zoomed out view. And that view can look like anything you want to. This is an alphabet is a really obvious way because it's a good way of organizing your content, but it could also be categories, or it can be colors, or it can be whatever you want it to be. And what it does is this helps me to quickly go to the beginning or the end of a list, or to jump to the middle of a list, or to jump to specific areas of that list. This is a feature that our users, what we discovered in our test, that our users particularly like. So I just want to show you one for fun of a user who really liked that. And this is also another example. This is a fake Netflix app. It's not an app that we actually developed. It was just a very simple prototype that shows categories of movies. So you can zoom out to those categories.
Oh my god, that is crazy. Yeah, that's cool. And then... Yes, that's very... I like that a lot.
So, and what happened is once people in the studies discovered this feature, then they wanted to keep using it. So they tried to use it everywhere in the system and see if that would work. Let me see. Oh, no, I don't have that here. So again, semantic zoom, it provides a touch-first way of jumping into content, so the alternative to the scroll bar. There is actually a semantic zoom control that you can use to kind of enable this in your app. So touch feedback is another important topic for the touch language. What is really important, basically the way to see this is, if I'm touching the screen, what I'm doing is I'm communicating to the computer. I'm telling the system to do something, right? Move this item over here or open this item. So the way I see that is it's a conversation. I'm having a conversation with the system. A lot of computer systems, as far as I'm concerned, are not very polite. Basically what they do is they kind of stand like this while you are touching them, and they don't tell you or show you anything until suddenly they come out and they start doing something. And an example is when you touch when you touch a screen, you don't get any feedback about that you have touched it. So if the system happens to be slow or the app takes a while to open, you don't know that anything is happening. And a great example of this is the touch screens that you have in airplanes. I was once traveling in one where there was somebody behind me playing a game. And every time there would be an announcement, that system would be disabled, right? So it says announcement on there, and the touchscreen doesn't work anymore. But the person who was sitting behind me didn't understand that exactly. So every time there was an announcement, my head would bob up and down because this person was banging on the screen harder and harder because the system didn't hear me, so I probably have to bang harder to make it hear me. And basically, the system was being rude, as far as I'm concerned, because it wasn't saying, like, I hear you or I don't hear you. It just wasn't saying anything. So we wanted to solve that. And the way we wanted to solve that is by always providing touch feedback. Okay, now I have my wrong visuals on, but anyway. So what you can see here is that when I'm putting my finger down on the screen, you'll see the circle here. And then when I'm moving it, you'll see my hand moving. Now, these visuals are actually the presentation visuals. The real ones that we implemented in the system, you're welcome to come after presentation, I can show it to you, are much, much more subtle. So they're actually very light circles that you barely notice when you're using the system. So the reason is, when you're just using the system, we don't want you to see like, oh, I touched the screen, I touched the screen, I touched the screen, I touched the screen. It's kind of irritating. So normally when you use it, there will be this little circle and you won't really notice it. But when the system is not reacting, so either because it's slow or it hangs or because that thing that you touch just doesn't do anything, then you will start noticing that little circle. So then you'll be like, oh, the system heard me, but nothing is happening. So either it must be hanging, or either this must be a button, or this must not be a button. It's just a title that doesn't do anything. And in addition to that circle, we also have a little line that trails your finger. So when you try to scroll, in this case, if I move my finger back and forth here, the scrolling actually works. But sometimes maybe that doesn't work. If I move my finger here, it doesn't scroll. And then you will see the little line following your finger. So you understand, oh, the system heard me, but the thing just doesn't work. So it provides that basic understanding of what is happening with your touch. And as far as I'm concerned, that's just the system being polite to you, having a conversation with you. So that actually increases the user confidence, right? So it's, I understand what I'm doing, I understand why the system is reacting or not reacting, or maybe I don't understand why it's not reacting, I understand that it's not reacting. What we don't want is to have over-the-top feedback. So what we've done with the Windows 8 controls is they actually disable that touch feedback, because if you touch a button and the button highlights, then we don't need to show any other feedback, you're already getting feedback. So if you use the Windows 8 controls, then you automatically get that best feedback experience. And the thing that you can do here is to make sure that any other interactive elements that you're using, that they have some kind of visual feedback that say, like, oh, you touched me, I understand. You touched this button or you touched this element. Another aspect that I want to talk about is target sizes. So this is the question that I've been asked most, more than anything else. When I say I work on touch, people say, how big should my buttons be? And there's no clear answer to it. Or there's a clear answer, sorry. There's no simple answer to it. So, and I'll explain you what that means. There's not a target size that's right and another one that's wrong. What it actually looks like is like this. At the bottom, you see the different target sizes, so going from 3 millimeters to 14 millimeters. So in this case, they're just squares of 3 by 3 or 11 by 11. And then on the left-hand side, what you see is the error rate related to this. So to be able to answer this question of how big should touch targets be, what we did is we did lots of tests. We provided people with slates, different kinds of slates and laptops and different kinds of screens with lots of little squares on them, and then we asked them to tap those squares. We would highlight one square in a grid of squares and say, tap that one, tap that one, tap that one. Lots of tapping on squares. And based on that tapping, we could calculate what the error rates are based on different sizes of those squares. So as you can see, there's not like one answer like, oh, it should be this big or it should be this big. Basically, the smaller your targets get, you can make them very big, that works. The smaller your targets get, the higher the error is. And what we said is there's three target sizes that I think are interesting for us. There's a 7x7 millimeter target size, and your error rate for that will be 1 in 25, so 4%. There's the 9x9 target size. Your error rate will be about 1%, and then there's the 11. Yeah, there's the 11x11 or larger, and then your error rate will be 0.1%. Well, so what should you do with that? If you just want one answer, I will tell you use 7x7 millimeters. That's right in the middle. Your error rate will be 1%. So every time somebody touches that target that you created, like, or once out of every 100 times they touch it, they will miss it. But if you want to be really accurate, so for instance, in our start menu, if you miss a tile, or even worse, if you tap the wrong tile, it is pretty bad, because you will open an application that will take some time to open, then you have to close that application, go back to the start menu, and launch another app. It's pretty irritating. I don't think you even want that to happen 1 in 100 times. You want it to happen 1 in 1,000, or rather 1 in 10,000 or 100,000 times. So those tiles in the start menu are much bigger than that. They're even bigger than the 9x9 millimeters. But if you want to create a UI where you don't want to have lots of big buttons on your screen, then you can use the 5x5 millimeters. These sizes are all 2 millimeters smaller than the ones you saw in the previous slide, because what we recommend is that each target has a 2 millimeter padding. I'll explain that in a minute. So there's three sizes that we recommend. One is just the general size that works. One is if you want to be really accurate. One is if you want to optimize your UI for having small targets. An example for this last one, the small size, is radio buttons. Because if you tap on the wrong radio button, it's very easy to correct for that. You just tap again on that right radio button and you correct it. And actually, most people in our studies didn't even notice that they tapped twice. So there you can definitely go for this size. Now, the reason that we recommend this padding is not to increase the actual accuracy of tapping, but it increases the confidence of the users. So what we found is that if you have 2 millimeters of padding in between your targets, the people in the studies that we did, they thought it was easier to touch them. They felt more confident about touching them. So actually, if you add those 2 millimeters to the target sizes, then you get back to the sizes that I showed in that previous, in this graph here. So this is as far as I'm going to get today. We're talking about the touch language. What I try to do is touch on kind of on the most important aspects of the touch language, so the gestures themselves, but then there's also some other aspects like target sizes, what we talked about, or feedback that we're giving. And again, I wanted to kind of remind you of those the things that we talked about, that it's optimized for the input properties. So it's optimized for our anatomy. Our gestures are optimized for our anatomy, but also for how the screen works with that. Like, the computer system sees XY coordinates, it doesn't see full fingers. Then we defined different interactions, which are those basic, those 8 basic interactions that I showed to you. We make sure that we give good feedback, but we also make sure that we give good feed forward. So we're making the system look different than the traditional GUI. So you understand, oh, this works for touch. It's not that. Not the same as the old system, I mean. And the next step is to make sure that it is consistent across the whole system. And part of that is us designing the Windows 8 controls and the Windows 8 environment. But another part is all the app developers who are out there, who are creating their apps, and hopefully using that same touch language. So like I said, the advantage is if you use that language, it will be really easy for people to use your app because they will already know the gestures that are involved with it. So what we did is we created a 4-page overview of the touch language. So that's most of the stuff that I just talked about. It has a page with the basic behaviors. It has a page with the 8 interactions. And then one about the posture that I talked about, and one page about the target sizes. And that will be available on the Windows 8 site. But you can already get to the PDF document via this URL. So that's the most basic overview of the touch language that you can find. So what about other input methods? Because I talked about command line interface, graphical user interface, and then our Metro-style touch interface. But how does that Metro-style interface work for mouse? Because there's still a lot of mouse and trackpad that's going to be used. Well, actually, the way we approach that is we still wanted to have one environment that you can use, right? Because you don't want your interface to completely change when you use different input methods. So when you use the mouse, you will, as much as possible, you will have the same visuals in the same environment that you're working in. But sometimes those different the different input methods will provide a slightly different experience. So for instance, if you use mouse for scrolling, you will have a slightly different experience than if you use touch for panning through a list, and I'll show you that. From a developer point of view, is what we're saying is if you code for touch, you get mouse for free, because we created the controls in such a way that they'll provide that optimal experience. And where it makes sense, the controls actually change their behavior, and I'm going to show you the scroll bar in a minute. And then in addition, you have the possibility to create specific experiences per input method, because you will have access to that information. So I'll show you an example of scrolling. So again, if I scroll through my start menu with my finger, I just put my finger down on anywhere on the content and I can move it back and forth. But now when I start using my mouse, in the bottom you will see a scroll bar appear. So I'll show it again. If I use touch, I have just that thin line in the bottom, which we call the scroll indicator. And I can't actually touch that scroll indicator. It doesn't do anything. But if I use mouse, I get a scroll bar. And I can use the scroll bar just like how I'm used to. It has the little arrows that I can use to go line by line. It has the thumb that I can use to go to the beginning and the end. So that's a way of how the controls adapt to the different input methods, and they're slightly different visuals that we're using. Now for selection, the same thing. If I put my finger down, I can select something by sliding it down. But if I want to select with mouse, if I want to select with mouse, I right-click on it. So again, it has the same visuals. Didn't want to do that. It has the same visuals, but it has a slightly different behavior. Now I need to find my presentation back. There we go. Not in this version. Oh, sorry. The question was if you can drag a marquee over in the start menu to multi-select, and it's not in this version. And I can't really talk about the things that are going to come out later on. Okay, so like I said, now it's up to you, because if you want this touch language to be consistent, we have to get everybody to use this touch language. So I'm hoping that everybody's going to build great apps using that Windows touch language. And as I explained, it will make that app more intuitive and more enjoyable for people to use, because they know how those gestures work and they know what the behavior is. And as I explained as well, is that the controls, the Windows 8 controls, make it easy to implement that touch language. And I'll give you some pointers to more information in case you're interested in it. So tomorrow my colleague Jan-Christian Markiewicz is going to talk about how to create great Metro-style apps. There will be a little bit of touch in there, but also other aspects of it. And tomorrow I will talk about self-revealing gestures, which is about how can you teach those new gestures, what have we learned about that. But there's also talks that you can see that were given at the Build conference, which was in last September, and those are recorded, which are about how to build Metro-style apps. So talking about the controls, but also specifically about how you can use HTML5 or XAML to do that, And then how you can build your own touch experiences using Windows 8. And that's the end of this talk. Do you have any questions? Yes.
On my Xbox 360, I have it has that lovely Metro style interface.
Yeah.
But when I use it with the Kinect, swiping, moving around is okay, but to select something, it has those horrible time gestures.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. So the question is about Xbox. So Xbox has a Metro style interface, as we know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then if you use it with Kinect or with the controller, you can scroll back and forth, and it works all fine. But if you use it with Kinect and you want to select, you have to use a timed gesture. So it's a hover gesture. You hold your hand. You have to hold your hand still for a certain amount of time. There's actually a timer that goes, and then you select something. It is a way that we know of how to select something. I am actually working in Xbox right now, so this is the problem that that I'm working on. So I can't. So the question was, how would I improve this? So I can't really. I don't know yet, like what's going to happen with Xbox. But how would I improve this? Looking at this, is I would use swipe to select, because you can scroll horizontally in that menu, but vertically your vertical motion doesn't do anything, right? It just moves the cursor around. So you could swipe to select there. There's a whole bunch of other problems, because actually when you use Kinect, engaging is the hard problem, and I'll explain that a little bit. With touch, engaging is just touching the glass. So when I touch the glass, the computer knows, oh, now I'm engaging. If I have my hand above the glass, I can move it any way I want to, but the computer's not going to react. With Kinect, it doesn't work like that. When my hand's up, it looks at my hand, and it continuously is following my hand. It doesn't know, oh, did you want to scroll that list, or were you just scratching your nose? So the harder problem to solve there is, how do we engage using Xbox? And then it becomes much easier to create those gestures, because even swipe to select on Xbox would be hard if you don't have a good engage method. And there we have to look at what are the possibilities of the... So now I'm going to get into my language mode, my language story. We have to look at what are the possibilities of the technology and what are the human properties that there are. The technology is, if you use a Kinect unit, you use the depth camera. There's a whole bunch of details that I can get into after this presentation. Use the depth camera, and the resolution is relatively low, right, compared to touch on a tablet, for instance. So it's really hard to see smaller gestures like something like this, right, or I don't know, something you could use for engaging. Yeah, and then there's also this. You can use the depth map for doing something like this. And then there's also the hand, right, which is, it's hard to hold your hand still. It's kind of can be tiresome to make these kinds of movements. So those are all things that we have to think about to come up with a good gesture language that we can use for Kinect. And where we are right now is to use timed gestures, because it's something that we know. I would say it's stage two. We're in the old language. We know press and this is basically press and hold, but then you're holding it in the air. So it's something that we know that we've applied, but how can we come up with a new gesture or a new set of gestures that we can use for this whole new technology plus the human properties that we have? So that sounds a little bit like a cop-out, because I'm not giving you an answer of how to do it, but I actually, right now, I don't know how to do it, and I don't think anybody knows, but I think everybody's kind of thinking about it and working on it. It's a really interesting area. So I hope that kind of answers your question enough. I'd be very happy to talk about it more afterwards, actually. So, any more questions? Oh, two. I guess go there first, and then you.
One question. I think it's quite impressive. But the Dutch language is available in all the flavors, HTML5 and XAML and everything, or are there differences?
So the question is, is the touch language available on the different platforms, right? Is it available in HTML5 and is it available in XAML? Well, so those, as far as I know, those are the two platforms to code in, HTML5 and XAML. And yes, it is available on both of those platforms. I think in the build release, that was not even a beta release, right? So not everything was developed far enough there. but it will all be there. Those two platforms will be at the same level. All the gestures will be enabled. So yeah. So the answer is yes.
You get the same experience
in XAML and HTML5, and the some of the versions you saw here. So the start menu is kind of yet another bit of code, but that again is the same, provides you with the same experience. Yeah. So selection is the same, scrolling is the same, all the animations and things that are in there work the same way. Press and hold is the same, semantic zoom is the same. Yes. So the answer is yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So you're talking about like marquee selection, right? Could you? Yeah. That's a really good question. So the question is selection. Oh, that's great. You can move you can slide your finger down. But wouldn't it be great if you could put your finger down and then drag it over the screen, like you can do with a mouse. You do left mouse button down, you drag, you draw what we call a marquee, like a little rectangle, and you select everything that's in that rectangle. Yes, that would be a great way to do it, but we actually enabled another thing with that gesture, and I can show you that right now. Because in addition to selection, we also wanted to be able to move things around within a list. So I can select like this. But now if I want to move, say I want to move this music, I want to move this music app to the end of the list or to somewhere else, what I can do is I can put my finger down and I can keep dragging, and now I go into what we call a rearrange mode, so a move mode. So the tile is now stuck to my finger and I can move it over here and I can move it to the end of the list. Whoa. So the question is, can I cancel it? I can, if I lift my finger, I get out of that mode. So it's what we call a kinesthetically held mode. So that would be, but that's not the canceling you're talking about. The canceling you're talking about is, can I leave the tile where it is, I assume. So no, it will go where you lift your finger. So, but what you can do is, I can start here. Oh, let me grab the right one. I can start here and move it around, and I can say, oh, no, I didn't want that, I'll move it back. So the behavior you see here is because this is not a final version. There are still some bugs in here, obviously. So I can move it like this. So instead of enabling this marquee select, this way where you can select multiple, it's a continuous select. Instead of doing that, what we chose to is to enable rearrange, because we decided that that's a more important part of functionality than to have that multi-select in there. Yeah? Yeah. To rearrange, you mean? So to rearrange, you don't have to wait at all. You just slide further down. Oh yeah. So the comment is I have to, if I want to go all the way to the end of the list, I have to keep my finger on the screen. But there's all right. I have another feature for you here then. So what I can here now we're going into the multi-hand features. So what I can do is I can go into rearrange mode. So I'm in rearrange mode right now. Now with my other hand. With my other hand, I can actually scroll. So I hope you can see that. So I'm holding my one finger, I'm holding this tile, whereas with my other finger, I'm scrolling this list to quickly do that. And another thing that I can do is I can drag it to the bottom of the screen, and now I can drop it somewhere else in the list. So I can combine it with semantic zoom. So we have different ways of doing that faster. I agree, yeah, you have to hold your finger down on the screen, and in some ways that might be better or might be worse, but it comes with direct manipulation. So what we did is we found ways of making that easier to do. All right, any other questions? Yes. Yeah. So the question is, what about Windows Phone? So there's Windows 8 and Windows Phone, but so some of the, or actually I would argue that most of the interactions are the same, but some of them are different. And Semantic Zoom is a good example. I don't know if that's the one you were thinking of, but on the phone, you can go in your contacts list and you can tap on a letter, and then it goes to a screen that shows you all the letters of the alphabet instead of your full contacts list. So the way, so that's similar to Semantic Zoom, but the way you get there is by tapping on the tile. Now that has something to do with the properties, again, of the input method. So if I'm using my phone, many people will hold their phone like this and use the interface with their thumb, which means I have only a single finger available. So it's really hard to zoom with a single finger. You can try to do it like this, but it's kind of a pain. So most people will actually hold it in their other hand and then zoom with two fingers, which is really easy, but not if you want to use it for semantic zoom, which should be really fast and fluid. So whereas with a slate, because you're often holding it with your non-dominant hand and then you have your five fingers available, it's really easy to zoom. On the phone, it's not really easy to zoom with two fingers. So that's why there's a slightly different interaction. What will be really nice is if we can make sure that if we can align all of those. I am not entirely sure yet if that makes sense. So maybe we should just say, well, this is a slightly different form factor, so we'll have slightly different interactions, whereas many of the other interactions work the same way. I hope that answers your question. Any other questions? Okay, I think that was good timing. Thank you very much for coming.